From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. Terry Gross is out sick today. On this edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear Terry's interview with zoologist Alan Rabinowitz. He spent years trying to save the world's tigers, leopards, and jaguars, and the forests they live in. Also today, we remember Oscar-winning cinematographer Nestor Almendros, who died last week. His legacy includes the films Days of Heaven, Kramer vs. Kramer, The Blue Lagoon, and Billy Bathgate. And book critic John Leonard reviews Outer Bridge Reach, the new novel from Robert Stone, who won a National Book Award for his novel of Vietnam, Dog Soldiers. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iowa Senator Tom Harkin quit the race for the Democratic presidential nomination today, promising support for whomever is eventually chosen to face the Republican nominee. Harkin dropped out after his campaign ran out of money without winning any primaries. He won party caucuses only in his home state of Iowa, Minnesota, and Idaho. Harkin's departure leaves the field to Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton, former California Governor Jerry Brown, and former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas. Harkin announced his withdrawal in a speech at Gallaudet University, a school for the deaf and hearing impaired. He said he chose the school because of his commitment to the disabled and to honor his older brother Frank, who's deaf. Former Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin was buried on Jerusalem's Mount of Olives today. Tens of thousands of Israelis attended the funeral. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
At Begin's request, the funeral was simple, with no eulogies. In accordance with Jewish custom in Jerusalem, Begin was buried without a coffin, wrapped only in a shroud. After the family left, hundreds of Israelis kissed the grave, some of them crying. Begin will be remembered for the peace treaty with Egypt, but also for Israel's 1982 incursion into Lebanon. Many Israelis believed that war was a mistake, and as it grew increasingly unpopular, Begin told his cabinet, "I cannot go on." He resigned and went into almost total seclusion. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
After months of speculation about the timing of the British general election, Prime Minister John Major is expected to name the date later this week. NPR's John Idstey reports.
Politicians and pundits are convinced Major will announce that April 9th will be election day in Britain. Major would like to be able to wait longer in hopes that the British economy might recover from its 18-month recession, a recession that's put his conservative government in grave danger of losing its parliamentary majority. But the election must be held by July, when the Conservatives' five-year term runs out. The bets are on April 9th, because that date would allow Major to get the biggest bang out of his election year budget, being unveiled tomorrow. The budget is expected to include tax cuts and other sweeteners designed to woo voters to the Conservative camp. Recently, the Conservatives have begun trailing the Labour Party in opinion polls, and the election is expected to be the tightest in almost 20 years. I'm John Idstey in London.
Fighting continued today in the disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh as foreign diplomats tried to arrange peace talks between the former Soviet republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan. The Itar Tass news agency said that Azeri forces shelled two Armenian towns in the region, while Armenian militants fired artillery into a nearby Azeri town. At least 46 people were reported killed in the enclave since Friday. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials lost almost 7 points today to close at 3,215. This is NPR. Turkey launched air strikes today against Kurdish guerrilla bases in northern Iraq. The Turkish government said that Turkish Kurds are operating from inside Iraqi territory, striking at targets across the border. Government officials said that today's airstrike was in retaliation for a Kurdish Labor Party attack on Turkish reconnaissance planes as they flew over northern Iraq. The Turkish Kurds have been fighting since 1984 to establish an independent Kurdish state in southeastern Turkey. German officials have arrested two Soviet immigrants for the attempted sale of lightly enriched uranium, a fuel for nuclear bombs. Dieter Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The two men were arrested by German authorities when they tried to sell about 2.5 pounds of lightly enriched uranium to Bavarian undercover agents in Augsburg, Germany. The two men are ethnic Germans who moved to Germany recently from the former Soviet Union. selling price for the enriched uranium, which was not of the grade necessary for building nuclear bombs, was just over $1 million. Authorities suspect the material offered for sale was intended as a sample, as proof the sellers could arrange for larger shipments. According to this week's issue of the investigative newsweekly magazine Der Spiegel, a dealer ring from the former Soviet Union has been trying to sell considerable quantities of nuclear material to German businessmen. For National Public Radio, this is Dietra Berger in Frankfurt.
Surgeon General Antonia Novello and the American Medical Association have called on R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company to stop using Camel cigarette ads with the popular Old Joe cartoon figure. Novello said today that the cartoon character attracts children to cigarettes. She cited a study last year that found that the cartoon camel was as familiar to six-year-olds as Mickey Mouse. Novello and the AMA also called on magazines, billboard companies, and newspapers to refuse to carry the Old Joe ads. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. Alan Rabinowitz is a New Yorker who spent the better part of the past decade in the jungles of Central America and Southeast Asia. Rabinowitz is a zoologist. His mission is to save the jaguar, the leopard, the tiger, and other endangered wildcats, and to save the rapidly disappearing forests they live in. In the mid-80s, he lived among the Mayan Indians of Belize, tracking jaguars and establishing the world's first jaguar preserve. That was the subject of his book Jaguar, which has just been published in paperback. In 1987, he was invited by the government of Thailand to study the habits of tigers and leopards so the government could assess how much of the forest would have to be preserved to sustain the cats. This work and the adventures and mishaps he had along the way are covered in his new book, Chasing the Dragon's Tail. The wildcats Rabinowitz is trying to save are the top predators in the forest. Terry asked him what would happen if these wildcats were to disappear.
There is a change, actually, and that change can be seen in the United States, where we once had pumas roaming and wolves roaming areas, and now there are too many deer which need to be culled, or they're becoming so abundant that there are problems in certain areas where people live. When you lose your top predators, the animals which they feed upon, which are usually in the case of things like tigers and jaguars and other large cats, they're mainly larger deer species, those animals start to become much more abundant because they're not under a strict control, and the weaker numbers of those species and members which were previously sickly and had parasites and would easily be taken by the larger cats as food, now they're also breeding as well as the stronger members of that species. So what you're getting actually is a weakening of the wildlife food chain when you lose your top predators, because your top predators, like the cats, serve to control all the things that come underneath it.
Now, you have an interesting technique for studying and tracking large cats. You attach little radio collars that have little transmitters on them, basically. Would you want to describe what you do there?
Okay, the animals which I study are species which have never been previously studied in these forest areas where I work. And the reason for that, which include my studies on the big cats of Thailand and the jaguars in Central America, it's all the reason that these animals have not been studied previously is because they're very secretive, solitary forest animals. And you cannot just walk in back of them and follow them or watch them or easily come upon them, even if you're tracking them in the forest. The only way to study them is a technique that's been around for quite a while now, nearly 30 years, called radio tracking, radio telemetry, where you actually capture the animal using some kind of a trap or snare, and you drug the animal, put the tiger or the jaguar to sleep, and then I attach a radio around its neck, and this radio is made as small as possible according to what the weight and the structure of the animal is. And this radio then will allow us to track the animal, to actually be following it in the forest, though I rarely ever see it again. Once I capture one of these big cats and set it free, it's very unlikely, actually, that I see it once again, because even when I'm tracking it and I try to come up very close to it, they're always one step one step in front of me, and they escape. They go away. So very often I'll be tracking these cats, and then I'll turn around to go back to my camp or to my field station, and I'll find that they've been tracking me. They would have circled around, and they're in back of me. So these radios will allow me to follow them without ever really seeing them again, without ever needing to see them again, though I try to, and I would very much like to see them in the forest. But it allows us to follow them, to find out exactly where they go and how much forest they use, what size forest they need. That's why this technique is so important. The reason I study large cats, which many people ask me, many people ask, why do I love large cats so much, or cats in general? And in actual fact, it's not the cats per se, which I love more than any other animal. It's that these large, wide-ranging predators are so important to saving the remaining tropical forest in the world, because they need more forest to roam over than any other species. But the only way to try to justify saving large areas of forest with governments, especially poor governments, is to say, well, if you truly do want to save your jaguars or your tigers, here we can show you that so many tigers need this amount of forest. And in order to find out exactly what that amount of forest is, which is usually a huge amount of area for the big cats, we need to put these radios on them and track them.
In your new book, you write that every time you capture an animal, you know, capture it so that you could just put the radio transmitter around its neck, that you have very mixed feelings. Can you describe what those mixed feelings are about?
Well, I love wildlife. I love animals. That's why I study them. Quite often, I think I love animals much more than human beings. That's why I first entered this field. So because of that, my ideal in terms of studying animals is what most people's ideal would be, and that would be simply watching them or being able to get close to them, possibly even touching them. But I don't feel good about affecting their life in any way. Now, we've done this kind of technique, radio tracking, drugging animals and putting on radios. I personally have done this for over 10 years now, and it's been done for nearly 30 years with many species of animals. So we know that if properly done, the animals are not hurt by it. But frankly, I also know that putting on radio still does affect them in some way, because I could see the change in their eyes, and I can sometimes even see the change in certain patterns of behavior when they go out. So I don't always feel good, though I know it's necessary, because there's no way we would be able to study them otherwise and get the data we need to protect them. It always saddens me when I capture something wild and free and I sort of leave my mark on it in the form of a radio collar, because then it's marked for good.
Yeah. Well, you know, to clarify, before you could put the radio collar on, you lay a trap for the cat, and then when they're trapped, you give them a tranquilizer so that you can attach the radio collar, and then you set them free. Now, early on in your work in Thailand, something went wrong with the trap, and it caused one of the cats to die.
Right. That was not a trap, though. That was a snare. That was what's called a cable snare, which actually I had very mixed feelings about using, because we know in the past there have been instances. Now, a cable snare is simply, it's sort of a modification of what hunters use in the forest. It's simply a snare set out in the underbrush. It's not something which an animal cannot see. It's set along a trail or a road where you know a big cat is walking or an animal you want to trap is walking. And when the animal steps inside of that loop which the snare is made into, the snare closes around its ankle and you capture it. Now, some animals, when they're captured, simply lie down and wait and don't fight. Some animals fight, and it tends to cause injury. in general, with the cats, we've had very mixed results using these kinds of snares. Very often, but more often than not, the cat, because their paws are so sensitive, that they will generally just lie down and not fight the snare. But in a few instances, they will fight and injure themselves. What I didn't expect is I got a cat. My first capture was used with a snare because we were building the large box traps and they weren't ready yet. And all I had was a snare, and we had found a big cat's kill, a tiger's kill, and wanted to try to capture that cat immediately. And I thought a lot about it because it was a choice of either waiting till that trap was built and then just hoping that we would find a fresh kill again and be able to capture that cat, or taking advantage of the situation and going after it immediately with a cable snare, which I knew I had more than 50% chance of it coming out okay. Well, it worked against me, and it was totally my fault, because I think it was a wrong choice and I will never use a cable again. It was a big male I caught, leopard, and he fought the snare a lot. And the snare did not wrap around his ankle. It wrapped around three of his toes, because as he had stepped in the snare and the snare started to close, he pulled his paw quickly upwards, and it closed around three of his toes. He tugged and tugged at the cable snare, because it was only 2 hours after he was caught till I reached him. And he tugged at the cable snare so much that it ripped through his skin and caused a fairly large injury to his paw. But that isn't really what killed him. What killed him was the shock and trauma of being captured in that cable snare and fighting it for more than 2 hours. And then when I got to him and I drugged him, and I saw that the injury was nasty, but it wasn't bad enough to cause the animal to die in the forest, because it was an area where the animal could clean and it would heal eventually and the foot wasn't broken. But I didn't count on trauma, and trauma is something that will often kill wild animals because they're not used to being captured and kept by man. So what eventually happened is I put a radio collar on him. I didn't have a cage or a pen to keep him and watch what would occur. So I had to make a decision to radio collar him anyway and hope that everything would be okay. And I radio collared him and followed him 4 days, day and night, and he eventually died, unfortunately.
It was suggested to you that the reason why this leopard might have died was because you didn't make an offering to the mother spirit of Dancing Woman Mountain, where the preserve was. So you thought about that and ended up making an offering to her. And I was wondering what went through your mind in deciding whether you should, you know, make an offering or not. I mean, it's part of a series of beliefs and traditions that you're not really a part of, but a lot of the people who you worked with were.
That's true, especially in Thailand, especially in the forest areas. Virtually everyone there believed in spirits and ghosts. And any place that you would go in the forest where there were people that were there, they would have these little wooden spirit homes, houses, for the mother or the father of the mountain. Usually it was for the mother of the mountain, because the mother spirit is seen as more powerful than the male spirit, actually. So at my field station as well, there was a little spirit house for the mother. In fact, my field station was called Dancing Woman Mountain, and that was for the mother of the Dancing Mountain. Whenever anything went wrong, not just this cat dying, but anything occurring, if a man was injured or something occurred in relation to my project, they would blame it on the fact that I hadn't made the proper offerings, or that I didn't truly believe in the mother of the mountain, because they felt in order to do anything in the forest that you had to ask permission of the mother. So, in fact, when this cat died, the men I worked with, the Thais, were very angry at me, because they don't feel that the cat should have died and that it wouldn't have died if I had made the proper spirit offering.
So did you make the offering for the sake of the people who you work with, or did you start to believe in it yourself?
Well, at first, when the cat died, the offerings which I made were strictly for the people, because they would no longer work for me unless I followed the proper protocol with the mother spirit. And as time went on, and in the course of 2 years, many strange things occurred in the forest. And to be honest with you, there were times when I wondered what was real and what was not real. Not that I came to believe in it eventually, but I came to realize that there was a lot out there I had no idea about and couldn't rationalize in scientific terms.
I think what you were supposed to give in the offering is a sign, one sign of how, you know, the modern world intrudes on the traditional world, that your offering consisted not only of pigs' heads and chickens, but whiskey and cigarettes.
That's right. Because after you make an offering to the mother of the mountain, you let the mother feed upon and smoke the cigarette and drink the whiskey or feed upon the offering for about an hour or so, and then it's okay for you to eat the food. So whenever I had to make an offering, the men made a shopping list to make sure it included a lot of the things that they really liked and couldn't afford normally either, because we would always get to feast upon it as well afterwards.
So was there a certain brand of cigarettes you were supposed to use for this offering?
Yes. Actually, when they offered it to the Mother Spirit, it would always be a very cheap brand. And when I had to make an offering, I had to go out and buy a very expensive brand of cigarettes.
Well, there you go. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Rabinowitz, and he's a research zoologist with Wildlife Conservation International, and he's written a new book about his work in Thailand to try to save the large cats there. It's called Chasing the Dragon's Tail. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Zoologist Alan Rabinowitz is my guest, and he's the author of the book Jaguar, about trying to save the wild jaguars in Belize. And he's also the author of a new book about trying to save the large cats in Thailand, and that's called Chasing the Dragon's Tail. For some people, this would have, like, symbolic value. You ended up getting caught in one of the traps that you had set. You were actually trying to unfasten a pig whose harness was caught on the trap, and the trap got your leg and broke a bone. What went through your mind when you were trapped by one of your own traps?
That was a strange experience for me. In the 10 years I've worked in the forest and I've trapped and radio-collared animals, that kind of incident has never occurred to me, and I've never felt that kind of fear before. One thing I'll clarify is that we use live bait in these traps because these big cats will only come in and feed upon live bait in these forest areas where their prey is normally relatively abundant, that they won't take just meat or dead animals. So I would use live pigs placed in the back of these traps in order to attract the large cats, and they would then come in and trigger the trap and get caught. So every day I had to go out and feed and water these pigs as well and make sure they were okay and everything was fine with them. In this one case, it happened to be the most remote trap, the furthest from camp, and the pig was very tangled, and I was in a hurry in order to get back and eat breakfast, actually. And I did something I never normally do. I entered the trap from the front entrance instead of feeding the pig from the rear of the trap because I wanted to do it as quickly as possible. And I crawled into the trap, and I hurriedly started to untangle the pig because he had gotten tangled in the rope which attached him to the trap. And I touched and I brushed against the trigger of the trap. And I knew as soon as, in the split second I hit that trigger, I knew that the trap door was going to be coming down within a second. And that's when I had to make some kind of a decision because I was all alone in the forest. Nobody knew exactly where I was or where this trap was except for me. And we have special locks built on top of the trap so that when the trap door closes, you cannot pick the door back up again because we've had instances of big cats, tigers, and jaguars using their powerful jaws to open these trap doors. So when you're locked in the trap, if it's strong enough for a tiger, believe me, it's strong enough for a human being to be locked inside and not able to break out. So in the split second, I knew I was going to be trapped, and I had the fear. The only way I can describe it is the fear that must go through an animal's mind, because it was terror. It was terror of being closed in this trap and nobody knowing where I was, or it would have been pitch dark inside of the trap. And I knew I could probably dig my way out eventually, but it could have taken days if I could do it. So what I did is I threw my leg back and took the full brunt of the 40-pound door, which just came straight down. And I knew it would be painful. I didn't expect it to break my leg the way it did, but it actually snapped the bone, and it stopped the door from closing totally, so that the lock for the door didn't engage. So I wasn't trapped in there, but the fear of possibly being trapped in there forced me to do what I knew would be extremely painful, and that was to throw my leg backwards and take the full brunt of that iron door on my leg, which did break. And then I had to try to get back to camp. I was about 4 miles from my camp. And I had to get back through crawling and doing several other things with a broken leg.
So did this have a lot of symbolic value to you when you got trapped by your own trap?
Well, symbolic, I'm not sure that's the word I would use. What it did is it gave me a new awareness, a new appreciation of the fear and terror that these animals must go through inside of these traps. I'm not even sure fear and terror are the right emotions, but eventually what I started doing, because I started wondering just how bad their fear and uncertainty was in these traps, so what I started doing was I hooked radio collars to the trap itself, so that even if they got trapped in the middle of the night and I was sleeping, I would have a radio receiver by my bed turned on, and if the trap got closed, if they got trapped, it would pull a certain magnet off of the radio collar and turn the radio collar on, and I would know they were trapped, so I could go out and get them immediately.
You know, I can't help but wonder what keeps you going on this kind of work. You've been really seriously wounded in action several times. You've broken a leg in a trap. One of the large cats nearly bit off a hand. That's a long story, but, I mean, he was very sick and you were trying to help him. You were speared in the foot after a motorcycle accident and had blood poisoning. You were in a plane crash. I mean, I could go on, but you certainly put yourself at risk doing this kind of work, and I would think you'd be ready to retire from it.
Well, actually, I think about that all of the time. My body tells me that I should retire soon, but my mind and my spirit tell me that there's absolutely nothing to retire to, because I see no alternative. My life and my enjoyment comes from being in the wild places with the wildlife. When I get very tired and I come back to see my family in New York, or I go back to the United States, it takes me no more than a week to realize that I want to be back out there in the wilder places, though it's fairly wild in New York as well.
Different kind of wild.
Yes, a more dangerous kind of wild.
Well, Alan Rabinowitz, I wish you good luck in your future work, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
Zoologist Alan Rabinowitz. He spoke with Terry Gross last November. Rabinowitz's new book about his study of the wildcats of Thailand is called Chasing the Dragon's Tail. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Way back in the early 70s, Nestor Almendros was already being called one of the world's best cinematographers. And that was before his work on films such as Days of Heaven, Kramer vs. Kramer, and The Blue Lagoon. Last week, we lost one of the world's best cinematographers when Almendros died of cancer at the age of 61. Coming up, we'll remember Nestor Almendros. Also today, book critic John Leonard reviews Outer Bridge Reach, Robert Stone's new novel about a man facing his personal demons while sailing alone around the world. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A day before Super Tuesday, Iowa Senator Tom Harkin has pulled out of the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Harkin, who was often seen as angry and caustic on the campaign trail, today joked about his ill-fated quest for the White House.
My wife, Ruth, has been keeping a journal of this campaign. After the past few weeks, she told me she was thinking of entitling it after this recent Chevy Chase movie, Memoirs of an Invisible Man. My advisors told me not to peek too soon. I think I took him too seriously.
After failing to win at least 10% of the vote in the last two primaries, Harkin is no longer eligible for federal matching funds. He is $300,000 in debt, and in the end, his call for a new deal didn't connect with a generation of voters more familiar with MTV than FDR. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Governor Bill Clinton has now moved ahead of uncommitted delegates in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. With a solid win in South Carolina over the weekend and 24 delegates chosen in caucuses in Wyoming, Arizona, and Nevada, Clinton now has 259 delegates. There are 236 elected delegates who say that they are uncommitted. Paul Tsongas has 136 Democratic delegates, and Jerry Brown has 56. On the Republican side, President Bush has 184 delegates, and challenger Patrick Buchanan has 20. Former Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin was buried today on Jerusalem's Mount of Olives. 14 years ago, Begin won the Nobel Peace Prize with Egypt's Anwar Sadat for the Camp David Accords. Laurie Neff reports from Cairo.
Former Egyptian Ambassador Ashraf Gorbal praises Menachem Begin for signing a peace treaty with Egypt, saying it showed peace was doable between Arabs and Israelis. Veteran Egyptian diplomat Tassim Bashir says the former Israeli prime minister showed courage when he agreed to give back Egypt the Sinai Peninsula in order to achieve peace. However, Bashir is among Egyptians who criticized Begin for not negotiating autonomy with the Palestinians and not ending settlement activity in occupied Arab lands. Egypt's president has sent Israel a message of condolences, and the foreign ministry is praising Begin for having the courage to negotiate land for peace with Egypt. However, the ministry, often critical of the Jewish state's unwillingness to give up land for peace, used the occasion to press the current Israeli government to follow Begin's example. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
Police in Beirut, Lebanon say during 15 years of civil war from 1975 until 1990, more than 144,000 people were killed. During that same time, nearly 200,000 people were injured. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 6 points in moderate trading. This is NPR News. A top official in Germany says that he expects that Chile will now let former East German leader Erich Honecker be extradited from Moscow. Except for a brief period in the hospital, Honecker has been inside Chile's embassy in Moscow for 3 months now, since Russia threatened to deport him. With the aid of the Soviet military, Honecker fled Germany a year ago and is wanted on manslaughter charges in connection with shoot-to-kill orders for those trying to escape to the West. In South Africa, at least 30 blacks have been killed as renewed violence increased throughout the country. The killings come just as white South Africans are ready for a crucial vote on reform. NPR's Renee Montaigne reports.
A big issue in whether whites here accept or reject continued reform is political violence of just the sort that erupted over the weekend. Some of the worst occurred in Alexandra, a black township located in the heart of Johannesburg's prosperous and traditionally liberal white northern suburbs. Four people were killed in Alexandria this morning in fighting that began Saturday when mourners were ambushed and killed as they followed a funeral procession for a slain Inkatha man. Down in Natal, where a virtual civil war has raged between Inkatha and ANC followers for years, four more were killed in the township of Mpumalanga. The latest fighting comes just weeks after the two sides there signed a peace accord that residents of Mpumalanga had hoped would end the violence. In Johannesburg, I'm Renee Montaigne.
Secretary of State James Baker is now in Brussels, where he is expected to tell foreign ministers of the European Community that the Bush administration is ready to give diplomatic recognition to four breakaway republics of Yugoslavia. Baker says that he called for the meeting so that questions could be answered about support for UN peacekeeping efforts. 45 nations led by Germany have already recognized the breakaway republics. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Cinematographer Nestor Almendros died last week in New York. He was 61. Film director François Truffaut once called him one of the greatest directors of photography. They made 9 films together, including Bed and Board, The Wild Child, and The Last Metro. He also shot Eric Rohmer's My Night at Maud's and Claire's Knee. In the United States, Almendros was a cinematographer for Kramer vs. Kramer, Sophie's Choice, and Places in the Heart. He won an Academy Award in 1979 for his work on Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven. Almendros grew up in Spain. After the fascists won the Civil War, his father left for Cuba. The family joined him in 1948. Almendros despised the Cuban film industry under Batista and went to France as a young adult. But he returned for a while after the revolution and wrote film criticism and directed documentaries. His recent films include Martin Scorsese's segment for New York Stories and Billy Bathgate. He also co-directed a documentary called Nobody Listened about human rights violations in Cuba under Castro. Terry Gross spoke with Almendros in May of 1988.
Let's start with Days of Heaven. That's the movie that you won your Academy Award for. It's set in the American Midwest during the Depression, and there's a scene in which all the field workers are trying to pick, the locusts have invaded, and they're trying to pick the locusts off the wheat fields. And they're picking them off and then burning them. But for reasons I won't go into, the wheat field catches on fire. And there's a huge fire that engulfs this enormous wheat field. And you have all the characters silhouetted in basically black outline against these wheat fields. It's absolutely stunning. It's very hard, I'm sure, to film a fiery scene like that.
No, it isn't, in fact. Well, first of all, to begin with, we had to have a scene that gave opportunities to the cinematographer to shine. And here was a big fire. It wasn't the script. Terrence Malick had thought about it. He's a sort of a pyroman, do you say, or an arson man.
Pyromaniac?
He loves fire, you know. And also, he's a man from the country. He was from Oklahoma and Texas. He knows the fields. He worked in the harvester. So he knows that very well. Now, how you solve that, that's where I come. I believe that very often when you have a fire seen on the movie, they always have arc lights lighting on the dark side. And then by doing that, they destroy the effect of the fire. I thought that it would be better not to do any lighting and just leave them in silhouette, as you noticed. And it makes like a cave painting in a way. And there's a great beauty. Of course, we ask the people to be in profile because that's how you know a little bit who is who.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, Richard Gere and Brooke Adams, they are in profile and silhouette, so you know who they are. There's a little trick, but we did 2 takes, one with light, for instance, in that scene, and one without.
With artificial light.
Yes, just to fill up, you know, so you would read on the faces. I thought that the one in silhouette would be better, and I was glad that Malick chose the one in silhouette.
Now, in the scene, there are sparks flying. It's very smoky. How do you keep a camera lens clean to observe all of this?
It isn't clean. The cameras have to be cleaned afterwards. They get dirty. And then we got the smell of a smoke. The fire scene was shot during 10 days. It was, and the film is only 10 minutes perhaps. But it was 10 days. We burned a different field every day. And we were all smoky, and we had goggles to protect ourselves from the smoke. And the cameras, it's a miracle that nothing happened, but they could have been damage, you know. There's always a little bit of risk in that kind of thing.
You said you burnt a different wheat field every day. How did you find fields to burn?
Well, that belonged to a religious group called the Hutterites, but they're related to the Memnonites. They have enormous amounts of wheat. They have enormous amounts of field because it's collective ownership. And they just sold it for the price of the harvest. They were very happy. They didn't have to harvest and they got the money from it.
Now, let's compare what you did on Days of Heaven with another movie that you shot. You shot Kramer versus Kramer. Now, Days of Heaven has obvious opportunities for incredible photography because you're talking about landscape shots, you're talking about period photography. It's made in the Depression. Kramer versus Kramer is a naturalistic movie set in apartment buildings and office buildings, and it's a very, you know,
it's
realistic type of movie.
It's the most difficult thing to do.
Now, I think it would
fact,
be the other way around.
That a period movie. The other one is piece of cake. You know, making a film with landscapes and waterfalls or. They're the films that win Oscars always, and frankly, non-deserved very often. The moment you have a film with thousands of extras, costumes, especially if it's a costume movie in India or in South America or in a period movie like ours, which people were not dressed like today, and you have mountains and fields and clouds, but that's there by Mother Nature. Yet people think, oh, what wonderful photography, and it's the easiest thing of the world. But doing an apartment like in Kramer, every day, you know, everyday banality, get beauty out of it. That's the toughest thing.
Mm. When you're arranging the light so that you'll have exactly the kind of effect you want to achieve, then the character's going to move. I mean, is that a problem, that if you want a certain dramatic lighting effect, that they might move the wrong way or move right out of
that
effect?
Well, that's a compromise. In fact, the good way should be let the actors do their number first and then do the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do the lighting and then you ask them to move into the lights.
So you watch them rehearse first and then
first
figure out how to light
it. First, the director decides where they should do, where they should go, and then I'll come and I'll do some lighting. And sometimes we will tell them, why instead of walking there, don't you walk to the other side so you'll get a better light? And some actors like Meryl Streep, Jack Nicholson, they have a good sense of light. They really know where the light is. Sometimes you don't even have to tell them. They have tropism, you know. They know where the light is.
Now look at someone like Dustin Hoffman. He's got a very big nose, a kind of unusual face. Does he require a certain kind of lighting?
Well, he is like a chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
You say that?
Chameleon, yeah.
Chameleon, yeah. He can be anything. In Kramer, he's very handsome.
Mm-hmm.
And so is in... the first film he made, The Graduate.
Right.
And if he wants to be ugly, then he can be Rizzo in that film...
Midnight Cowboy.
He can be anything he wants, like Meryl Streep, too. Meryl looks very ugly in Ironweed, and she wanted to be, you know. And I thought that we made him look quite good in Kramer. He looks like... I mean, he's not Gary Cooper, but he's an acceptable man, I think.
What do you look at in a face when deciding how you're going to light it?
Well, I belong to the Greek or Roman tradition, so I do have an idea of beauty, which of course has to do with that inherited culture that we have. I mean, if a person has a huge nose, then we'll try to not to show that, because the Greeks had that sense of proportion. The mouth could not be that big, the nose and the eye should be of a good size, and the ears also. So I look at that first without any consideration for the light. I try to see the person as you see an animal, not really forgetting that you are a man, you know. And then once you see these defects that the person might have, you try to conceal them with the lighting or with the framing or with the position of the person in front of the camera. You know, if a person has an ugly profile, you'll try not to have this person in profile very often. And if it has a beautiful profile, then it's the opposite, you know.
We're listening to an interview with cinematographer Nestor Almendros, who died last week. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We continue with Terry Gross's interview with cinematographer Nestor Almendros, who died last week.
Let's talk about black and white versus color. You have shot some movies in black and white, including My Night at Maud's.
Yes.
Of course, you started, unlike film history, which started in black and white and went to color, you started in color and did a few films in black and white.
Yeah.
Now, Wim Wenders, when I recently interviewed him, said that black and white is the most difficult thing
to shoot
and to develop. Do you agree with him?
Yes, it is very difficult because, it is difficult and it is easy. It has some easy aspects and some difficult. The easy one, I'll start by that, is that it's very elegant.
Yes.
You cannot be of bad taste in black and white. Everything looks correct. You see the worst movie of the 40s, which was in black and white, and there's always a basic elegance. I mean, things, they never have that gaudy aspect that bad movies have today, you know. Then the other problem that black and white has is that because of the lack of information of black and white, the lighting has to be like a painting. You have to be silhouetting things, singling out objects and things you want to see, because you see much less in black and white.
Because it's all shades of gray.
Because
there's no colors to stand out.
There's very little to tell. People have to see what's happening with only black and white, whereas the other one, there's an infinite amount of colors which tell you different things. So you have to color black and white has to be much more refined, you know, and much more work if you really want to do something that people can recognize.
Since the labs don't have to process that anymore, do they know what they're doing?
That is one of the problems, too. That's why I don't like to do black and white today, because the results are always very poor. And those who have this obstination, like Woody Allen, for instance, of doing black and white, they bump into a wall. I mean, it's just, what can you do? It's such an unusual thing. Labs don't know how to handle it anymore. And also cinematographers, us, we don't know how to do it anymore. It's an art perdu, lost art.
You know, you mentioned earlier that when you started working in movies, that you were the director and the cinematographer. You were directing the documentaries and you were shooting them too. Things have gotten very, very specialized, perhaps more so in America than in other countries.
Well, but on the other hand, that director-cinematographer figure, it still exists. There are still many directors of documentary. I believe the documentary should be done by the cinematographer. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, how can a director tell a cinematographer do that and do this? You know, there are always instant reactions that it's impossible to develop. So, no, there's still many people who do documentary and who are like an homme orchestre. No?
Do you think things are too specialized? For instance, in America, you point out in your autobiography that the cinematographer can't run the camera.
Well, this is the legitimate Hollywood cinema unionized.
Mm-hmm.
But there is also in America, parallel to that, you know, non-union movies and movies made, thank God, you know, in the other way, in avant-garde and with little crews and lots of little money. That film we made, Nobody Listened, was made that way. It's a non-union movie with very little money and an incredibly small crew.
You've made nine movies with late François Truffaut, and after Cuba went to France, and this was at the tail end of the French New Wave.
Or? Yes, in fact, I always have that image. Is that it's like if I got the last car of a train that was already speeding up.
How did that change you, seeing the French New Wave movies and then working with the French directors when you got there?
Well, I didn't work right away. I was, for 4 years, I was starving in Paris. I went back into teaching. It wasn't easy. And I didn't even have money to go to the movies. I skipped many of the movies of this early period because I couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a miracle, really, that I got to work with these people. And as I say, I got the last car. You know, some people identify me with a new wave. In fact, I got into the middle of it, you know. I was lucky enough that I still got it.
But once you did start working as a cinematographer, how did what you were doing change you? I mean, what was different than what you would... Obviously, it was feature films, it was fiction film.
What I had done before?
The technique.
Not really, nothing. In fact, if what I brought into movies, if I have brought into movies, is my experience in documentary, because that's what I had done in Cuba. I did documentary with no lights, with available light. So when I did My Night at Maud and La Collectionneuse and The Wild Child, I use that technique. It's like they're like documentaries in a way.
Do you feel that many viewers think of the cinematographer too much as a technical person, part of the technical crew, as opposed to part of the artistic vision behind
yes,
the movie.
Yes, that's one of the mistakes. I think the schools, film schools, they always have those exams as to accept people, and they are always insisting in mathematics and chemistry and things like that, which really you use very little. If you are a cinematographer, unless you manufacture film and you go out to Kodak to work in laboratories, but otherwise, you don't really need that. And I think by doing that, they eliminate the people who are artistically inclined. And I think it's an art. I think it's an artistic activity. I don't know if it's an art, but it's an artistic activity, as being a cinematographer.
I have friends who tell me that their lives were changed by going to Italy because the light is so beautiful. Is it true that the light is different in different countries, and does that affect your work?
Well, the light is the same everywhere, but it bounces differently against the architecture of Italy and the vegetation. That's what they mean. Of course, some countries have more clouds than others, but, I mean, sunlight is the same. No, but the look of the countries, of course, it does make a difference, but the world is shrinking, you know, and I don't find any problem about moving from one country to another. On the contrary, it stimulates me. I like this change. Like I do, I like to do a big movie and then make a little one, and make a fiction film and then make a documentary. I like the alternate.
We only have a couple of seconds left, but what do you think are the movies that cinematography should be measured against? The greatest, the best shot movies that you've seen?
Well, I think that the films which have to do with common things, that's where you can measure a cinematographer. As I said before, films with landscapes, they're the ones that pay the most, but they're not how you should measure a cinematographer. See a normal day, everyday film, and that's it.
Cinematographer Nestor Almendro spoke with Terry Gross in May of 1988. He died last week in New York at the age of 61. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. Iowa Senator Tom Harkin leaves the Democratic presidential race. He congratulates his fellow candidates for a job well done. Elizabeth Arnold reports tonight on the recent days of the Paul Tsongas campaign. Our colleague Linda Wertheimer talks with Republican women in the state of Louisiana. They plan to support, grudgingly, President Bush, saying there are indeed no alternatives in sight as far as they're concerned. Also, the chairman of the board of the Christian Science Church is resigning, and the church is planning to sell its cable TV operation, the Monitor Channel.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today, coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Novelist Robert Stone has written about the dark side of New Orleans, the jungles of Vietnam, and the phony glamour of Hollywood. His new book, Outer Bridge Reach, is about a discontented American who takes to the sea. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Owen Brown is somebody new in a Robert Stone novel. Northeast middle-class normal, white and waspy, as if wandering in from Updike or Cheever. A monogamous husband, a worried father, a Navy vet, and a sailboat salesman. He believes, says his wife, in all those things people used to believe in, like virtue and duty. Yet Owen feels that he's a stranger in his own home, his own bed, and his own country, as if he thinks he had been preparing all his life for something he would never live to see. To an old Navy buddy, he cries out, "You have no idea how rotten my life has been, how pedestrian and dishonorable." And so Owen agrees to circle the world in one of his sailboats, as a publicity stunt for the go-go conglomerate that owns him. We spend the first slow half of Outer Bridge Reach getting Owen onto that water, and we meet a lot of people. I'll only mention two of them. His wife Anne, a female Owen who drinks too much, and Strickland, a documentary filmmaker with whom Anne will have an affair while Owen's at sea. Stone has some trouble with Anne. She seems too much a projection of Strickland's vengeful fantasies. But someone like Strickland shows up in all Stone's novels, the self-marginalized know-it-all. These know-it-alls, journalists, anthropologists, screenwriters, spiteful alcoholics, and out-of-control cokeheads, can be counted on, like Strickland, to do more damage than the freaks and sociopaths with whom they traffic, and to quote Yeats while doing it. Strickland calls Owen a dorky citizen, but secretly he suspects that Owen may be something more, beyond the powers of the camera. Brown Agonistes, the charioteer, embarking for the insulted and the injured, the losers and the lost, as he bore away their wounds and washed them in salt. The handsome sailor. The last 200 pages of Outer Bridge Reach are as dazzling as anything in our literature. The journey's real enough, but it's also, of course, the passage of a soul through symbolic storms. A plague of insects infesting the wind, a strange great cloud and the shadow of the shark, curving bands of violet and dark green aurora light, black waves, freezing rain, and geometries of Antarctic iceberg, an island hanging upside down, and memories of Vietnam, the demented voices on the shortwave radio of Christian missionaries and particle physicists, a lagoon in the crater of a volcano, a penguin army, and a beach littered with the bleached bones of dead whales. From the handsome sailor reference, you may recall Billy Budd. The whale bones will certainly remind you of Moby Dick. And there's a lot more Melville. Shakespeare, too, and Joseph Conrad and Edgar Allan Poe, but mostly Melville. More than manhood, more than America, like Ahab, Robert Stone has always hounded after God, and like Ahab, discovered his absence. The passage of Owen's soul, moreover, has the shape of all great mystic journeys, from St. John of the Cross to William Blake to the Persian poet Rumi's Voyage of the Sufi Pilgrim Lapwing. The magnificent and mournful surprise is how Stone finishes off Owen's pilgrimage after the raptures of the deep. At the end of this brilliant journey, there is nothing left in which to believe.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Outer Bridge Reach by Robert Stone. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Audrey Fablitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our previously scheduled interview with Satare Farman Farmoyan. Her family was persecuted by the Shah of Iran, and even though she introduced the profession of social work to Iran, she was nearly executed when the Ayatollah took over. Also, we meet actor Michael York. That and more on the next Fresh Air.